Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Welcome to the Twilight Zone. This week we have a guest joining us, Mr. Ben Wooster. Ben, how you doing out there?
Nick, I'm doing just fine. Pleasure to be here in the, I guess are we in the zone right now?
Well, with what's going on outside, I feel like I'm in some sort of crazy zone, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
For those of you who don't know Ben, I remember him way back on Blame It on Outer Space, but right now you can listen to him on the Hooked on TJ Hooker podcast, which is why we have him here today, where they go episode by episode through the kind of classic cop show starring William Shatner, TJ Hooker.
That we do. We are mired in somewhere in season three right now. We, it's a labor of love, love for Mr. William Shatner. And the craziness of that TV show, and then Blame It on Outer Space, a show that it might be in a zone of itself right now somewhere. we're doing our best to see where it may have disappeared off to. You know, it might have slid into another dimension, but it's out there still somewhere.
You know, it's always funny when I think about such things, because I'm sure the question I remember, you know, I'm about your age. I remember when they would ask someone like Jon Stewart who would be more interesting to win the presidency so he could make jokes. Right. And it reminds me so do you think Blame It on Outer Space would be an interesting show now in this era of crazy conspiracy? And and I'm just I think he's probably half here watching a cop show.
Yeah, no, it's. It is a, not to get too into, these are interesting times we are in right now. And in all transparency, Eric and I are kind of our cop show right now. What's the best way to approach this? We've asked some folks online trying to take people's temperatures, and it does seem most fans kind of get a sense of where we're coming from. And, but that's not to say that the opportunity isn't there to sort of perhaps reassess, what we're doing and how we're doing it. Maybe that, it means there'll be a couple of more forthright takes on things, or I don't know. It's definitely interesting though. I wouldn't have stopped to kind of pause and look at it from afar. Clear, like a lot of people are doing now, if the events of the last couple of weeks hadn't transpired. So
sure.
We'll see what happens. The one thing we can guarantee though are the laughs, the LA double Fs.
well, and I mean, again, I'm with you, because part of it also is these old shows feel familiar. It's like slipping into a warm bath. That's my favorite part of the movie side of our podcast, is that, you know, sometimes it's just fun to watch something that you remember, even if you don't really you watch it, you're just it's fine. It's something to look back on and be like, oh yeah, okay, I remember this. And that's kind of why the first thing I thought of was, Weird Times when we started this was just the outbreak. And I was like, the Twilight Zone seems exactly like what's going on. Let's figure this out.
Well, I think it's an interesting, quarantine type show as well, because it's hard not to feel like you're in some sort of Twilight Zone, just being home for what's now, I don't know, what are we on, day 90 or something like that? It's wild. And any excuse to kind of go back and look at this stuff, I think is worth it. I mean, just with these two episodes that I watched recently for this, when you reached out with this opportunity, it kind of reminded me man, this show, there's a reason this show is just a tentpole. It's indelible. Like, people will always go back to this. It is just some of the best TV writing, period.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we should get into it. We've been dancing around it long enough. I'll start with our opening narration. Portrait of a Frightened Man. Mr. Robert Wilson, 37. Husband, father, and salesman on sick leave. Mr. Wilson has just been discharged from a sanitarium where he spent the last 6 months recovering from a nervous breakdown, the onset of which took place on an evening not dissimilar from this one, on an airliner very much like this one, in which Mr. Wilson is about to be flown home. The difference being that, on that evening, half a year ago, Mr. Wilson's flight was terminated by the onslaught of his mental breakdown. Tonight, he's traveling all the way to his appointed destination, which, contrary to Mr. Wilson's plan, happens to be in the darkest corner of the Twilight Zone. There's just something about that that, like, sends a shiver down your spine, isn't it? Like, so his writing and his voice, Rod Serling's voice in this, is so crystal clear. It's fantastic.
Well, you know, I mean, that's mistake number one right there, is William Shatner buying a ticket to the Twilight Zone. I mean, that's there's just, yeah, that's a recipe for disaster right there. No, but you're absolutely right, Nick. Like, I had not queued up a Twilight Zone episode in a while, and it really just kind of, it cuts into you, that kind of staccato seriousness of Serling, but with, like, a little, you know, there's a twinkle in his eye, because, like, you know, he's got the goods and he's gonna, like, mess with you. Like, yeah. It's such an interesting balance. I kind of forgot as well, like, how they will, it's not like they fade out to him, like, they kind of, these, the way he does his narration, they cut to him in a way, or pan to him in a way, where you're just like, oh, there's Rod. Like, and now he's, there he goes.
Right. He's just kind of standing by a pylon on the way to the airport. Like,
yeah, he's there.
He's just there.
Yeah. Because he's interdimensional. Like, he's phasing in and out of the Twilight Zone, you know, right, to all these different stories. I mean, if anyone knows where Blamin' on Outer Space is hiding right now, I bet it is Mr. Rod.
Okay. He's just there smoking his, like, his 12th cigarette of the last hour, just in face. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, of course, this is the episode that I thought of specifically for your show came to mind immediately, because the anchor of this is William Shatner.
Oh boy.
And he nails this, man.
Big anchor. Just amazing the plane even got off the ground with the size of this anchor. He comes in, Billy Shat comes in hot from the get-go. As soon as you see him, like, and granted, this is before he was a star, really. I mean, this is kind of early on in his career, but he's magnetic on screen. You know, I was taken from the get-go, and it was, in my opinion, too, like, as we go through this and talk about his performance more, but he was just on it for this whole thing.
Yeah, no, totally. And, like, something I always look up these things in this, but, like, he's, I think, 32 at this point, playing 37. It's so weird that in the 50s and 60s they'd be playing up, and how rare that is.
They specify his age in the,
opening scrawl. They say he's 37 years old.
Okay.
And we were talking about this a little bit before. This is directed by Dick Donner.
Oh yeah. Big Richie.
Still alive. The great Dick Donner, who did Superman 2, but he kind of got kicked off Superman 2, sort of, kind of. And so now you can see his cut of the film very much like what's going on now, the nonsense with Justice League. But he also did Goonies and Scrooged and Lethal Weapon and most of its sequels, so, and The Omen. Like, this is
a big name,
a huge pedigree for an episode of TV, which I guess lets you know how big the TV that the Twilight Zone was. He's great
to attract that talent, and I'm sure, like, he, you know, this kind of helped make a name for himself as well. I would imagine this episode, even back then, kind of was a, made an impact. They were going out strong too. Like, I didn't realize this was the, I think you mentioned it earlier. This is kind of the, this is the last season. They're on their end run, but they're not slowing down at all. And, you know, I mean, they got Rich in there, a man who, talk about a man who knows about flying high.
I mean, that's right.
Direct Superman. Wouldn't,
yeah.
What if William Shatner played Superman? Wouldn't that have been something?
He would have been great.
Kal-El. Yeah.
I actually think he would have been better
Shatterman.
Than actually better than Superman. He might have made a really solid Lex Luthor.
He could have done Lex Luthor. He could have done, if we're actually really like, what would have been the best? This may be a little blasphemous because I'm a huge Brando fan as well, but William Shatner could have Jor-El'd the hell out of that movie. Him, Superman's dad? Oh, man.
He might have actually pronounced Krypton correctly, that's for sure.
Just sashaying around in that shiny robe or whatever the heck he wore. Like,
among all the crystal white matte paintings? Oh, totally. Oh,
that's great. We need to bring back matte paintings.
Absolutely.
Matte paintings, I think, like, almost always just look fantastic. Why can't there be more matte? Is it just like a lost art? Does no one know how to do that anymore in movies?
I think people at the heads of studios are convinced bad CGI looks better. And I'm sorry, it never does. I would take a matte painting hand over fist every time.
Absolutely. Well, and why not even like show me some blending of the two? Like, do the matte painting and then like gussy it up with some, I don't know, some CGI. Like, you can make it, parts of it move or twinkle or whatever. I don't know. Like, I want to see something real on the screen.
Well, and actually, I guess to that point, this episode is probably the one that's been remade the most because it also appeared in the movie where it was directed by, George Martin. Yeah, George Miller, excuse me, the guy who did Mad Max, starring John Lithgow. And it was remade in the current version with Adam Scott. And it was a Simpsons episode. And, like, it so pervaded the culture that I think I would have seen it. I knew it before I saw it, so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah, I knew this, like a lot of things from The Simpsons. I knew this as a Simpsons episode. This was Treehouse of Horror. One of the early ones, where Bart is riding on the bus, I think Treehouse of Horror 4, and he sees the gremlin outside the bus window. And I think, you know, I didn't know at the time it was even referencing the Twilight Zone, but I mean, The Simpsons loved the Twilight Zone. There was tons of Twilight Zone references in the show. Mm-hmm. But coming back around to it, when I eventually saw it, I was like, oh, this is, I connected the dots, and it's just, one of the joys of the golden age of The Simpsons is finding those moments that you know from the show that exist in a movie, and you're kind of like, oh, that's what they were doing. I love that stuff.
No, absolutely. And I think all of this, and maybe I'm crazy, but we were talking about why this works a little bit. I think it works partially because it's black and white. It makes it seem so much more claustrophobic and creepy and stark. And I mean, even that episode of The Simpsons you're talking about, they gray out the colors substantially, if I recall, you know.
Interesting. I mean, I'm going to have to go back and revisit it now. It's been a while since I've seen it, but that's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, that's maybe the reason why I think so much of this remaking of the Twilight Zone doesn't work for me. The colors, I just, something about the black and white makes it really feel distinct in a way. And you have to plan your shots much more because there's less, you know, tricks to get it to work. And now I always feel like everyone's like, yeah, we'll just fix it in post with some computer nonsense and that kind of thing.
I think there's something to, you know, the old, I don't want to say formula, but like, I'm going to assume there's some Hitchcock quote out there about like suspense working better in black and white.
Sure.
Cause you know, that seems like a thing that would exist. But I think there's something to that. Like, there's the starkness of like the, you know, binary of blacks and whites and then grays and shadows. And I don't know, like that kind of, it definitely helps this episode. It helps the Twilight Zone in general.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess speaking of Hitchcock, that did you ever see that like 90s remake of Psycho? I think it was with Vince Vaughn.
No, I did not. But I know about it. Wasn't it a shot for shot remake by like what's that guy's name? Not Todd Haynes, but a director like him. Gus Van Sant, I think is who it was, right?
I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely.
And like I think I've never seen it, but I remember the hubbub around it because it's like, well, what's the point of doing this? Like,
well, and that's just it. Like that iconic scene where you see him move the picture away and peer through the hole that he's drilled in the wall.
Yeah.
Black and white, it's so stark because it's black and white. And when there's color, it just doesn't have the starkness, you know?
It doesn't. And actually, I thought of Psycho while watching this episode, specifically the scene where we first get, I mean, I'm fast forwarding a little bit, but when we get the reveal from when the curtain first gets peeled back and you see a close up of the gremlin, I had that same kind of like, you know, tingle up the spine that I get every time at the end of Psycho when, sure. when, you know, he turns around, he comes at him, you know, he's in this, oh, it's just like, it's impossible not to kind of feel that. And I think that there's something to, yeah, I mean, we keep saying starkness, but like, that's it. That's the word, you know, the starkness mm-hmm. of black and white. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. Well, we should get into this. I mean, again, like I almost feel like silly for describing the plot of this because, again, I feel like everyone's seen this. But like as we allude to, we kind of start out with, you know, Shatner with his wife or Robert Wilson with his wife getting on a flight to fly home. And he's clearly kind of anxious, nervous, like, but he's trying to play it cool. Like he had a freak out last time. He's got this. And every time he seems to gander out the window, there's a gremlin trying to tear apart the plane.
Right. Like, you know, and this is, you know, with my background on TJ Hooker watching, and maybe this is just something inherent to Shatner, who knows? But as great as this is, it's fun to just like kind of dissect it a little bit. And I love the fact that like, okay, we've got this guy he's crazy right off the bat, you know, and why is he crazy? Because he freaked out the last time he was on a plane. So let's put him on a plane again.
Like, right.
A little detail that, you know, was mentioned, I think it was might've been in the narration, but he was, he freaked out and was in a nut house for 6 months.
Yeah.
This guy has been, laid up for 6 months for who knows what. They don't actually specifically go into like what precipitated it necessarily, but yeah, like he sits down, he's ready to smoke. Did you catch that line? Like yeah. He pulls out a cigarette and I mean, it's the 60s, but I love that his wife is like, oh, no, no, don't do that. Wait until we're in the air to start smoking.
And they're just handing out sleeping pills later on. You're just like,
oh, my God. Well, that was a great moment, too, because like at first the wife takes a sleeping pill and he doesn't. And in my immediate reaction is like, why are you not sedating the nutball here? Like, riding on a plane makes him crazy. Like, give him a sleeping pill. And I thought they wouldn't come back around to it, but they don't leave that dangling. They do come back around to it. And I think that makes it even better.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and the whole time, like we alluded to, it's all Shatner's performance because there's maybe in the whole script, 100 lines. Like, it's a very stark script. It's just him looking out the window, then there's a lightning strike and you kind of out of the corner of your eye see something. And then more and more, it's clear something is actually going on. And again, you know, this episode, whether you've seen it or not, it starts to destroy the engines of the plane.
It's going right in on those engines. I think again, because of like the Treehouse of Horror episode, I forgot that the gremlin in question here is like a full size man in a like a monkey suit. Yeah. I think I remember in my head, because like the thing in the cartoon was like a smaller little gremlin on the bus. I was like, oh, right. No, this is a guy in just like a furry monkey suit, like a full size man. And that first shot of him too, speaking of just like the effectiveness of black and white, coming out of the shadows like that, you know, off in the distance, you're kind of like, what is that? Like, that was, again, just another moment of really unsettling creepiness. It kind of reminded me of, did you ever watch Twin Peaks, The Return?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Like the episodes when like the hobos and the shadows started like coming in and out, you know, like creeping around in the background. Like, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's so like the whole physics of the plane flying through the air doesn't seem to affect it, even though that's really big for the finale. So, you know, like in the back of Shatner's head, it's like, is this real? Is it not? Am I hallucinating? Which is really only revealed to be he's not hallucinating after the episode is over, which seems really cruel in a lot of ways.
I love that too, because it's like one of those great twists where, you know, you see the, you know, because he's freaking out because this gremlin is gonna get his dirty gremlin paws in the engines and cause everyone to crash, you know. Yeah. So he has to save people on the plane, and how does he do that? Well, you know, he's gonna go grab a gun, because you know, not only are we putting this nutball on a plane, you know, with a you know, where you can smoke, and you know, he's this is where he freaked out. We'll have a guy on here. We'll make sure to seat him near an emergency exit, and we'll also have a guy with a gun on the plane too. Like that's all just I think the perfect the perfect formula here for this for old crazy Bob Wilson.
Yeah, and also clearly give the air marshal with a gun the same sleeping pills you've been offering everyone, because he doesn't notice when a dude very unsubtly grabs his sidearm, which is just phenomenal.
The way they shot that was fantastic. Like that kind of front on thing, like they put the camera right behind the gun, and like Shatner, like, he like pretends to like throw something on the ground, and he's just like, the way he kind of comes up and caresses it, trying to take it out. That was fantastic. I was applauding that. At this point,
he's in a cold sweat. He's wide-eyed. Like, and again, like, it's all in his performance here, because there's almost nothing to this episode otherwise, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's calling over the stewardess my goodness, I'm tired. He's calling over. At one point, even the captain comes up.
Yeah.
There's something on the wing. And he's trying not to yell, but he's totally yelling.
Which, you know, I think you made a point of that. You got to chalk that up to just everyone on the plane is like out cold with these sleeping pills, right? Like, also, I think there's maybe, you know, this charming small set that they filmed this on, but it's like, you could kind of tell, oh, there's five people on this plane.
Like, very clearly, yeah.
But when the captain came over and he's kind of like patronizing him a little bit, I thought that was a great scene too. Cause like at first, you know, Shatner, they have these close-ups of him with his, you know, flop sweat. And he's like, he thinks he's making inroads with this guy. Like, yeah, there's someone out there. And then you can kind of tell, like, the switch gets pulled. He's like, oh, wait a sec. You're against me too. Everyone's against me. The paranoia, the fear, the obsession, this is a meditation on all those. And it's all hinged on Billy Shatz.
Yeah.
You're right. It's his performance.
Like at one point he looks at his wife and goes, oh, you didn't tell him because you'd be embarrassed, didn't you? And you're just like, whoa, buddy. There's a whole story there. And again, it's funny because like you said earlier, we don't know why he was in the asylum before other than he freaked out on a plane. Yeah. And part of you just wonders like, was there a gremlin before? Was he right the first time? And we just didn't see it that first time.
There's a man up there. There's a man.
No, please. I like the reveal of the gremlin each time. Like you said, the first time he kind of comes out of the shadows. The second time the curtains are closed and you open and he's stuck to the window as though he's a leech sucking on it.
That moment was fantastic. That's like the Twilight Zone at its best because you know something's going to happen. Like, you know it's coming. The curtain's closed. Like, you know, there's these those ebbs and flows of panic in the episode. Like, after the initial panic, like, everything kind of calms down again. And he's sitting there. He's like, okay, I'm going to drink my water out of a piece of paper. Which was, did you catch that? Like, what were those? Like, it's like a paper cup that turned into an envelope. Like, but then it's like, you know, it's that obsession part of the episode. Like, he can't not think about it. It's there. And like his hand slowly goes up to the curtain and you know he's going to pull and you're going to see something. And just it's still like that. The face is right there. He's like a monitor fish or whatever those like weirdo like things down in the deep are, you know, with those bizarre faces. He's just right there like sucking on. He's like Garfield up on the glass. And it's scary. Like, it's ridiculous, but scary.
Well, and it's funny how Shatner reacts because he closes his eyes as though it's like he doesn't want it to be there, as though he's pretending he's asleep like he knows he should be. And then like a bad memory, it's still right there. Uh-huh. And then it does the next step, which is starting to take apart the engine, which is just, again, it's like sticking its finger into the blades at first and then eventually pulling the cover off the engine itself.
Really nice design there too. Did you notice they had they had lighting underneath that engine? So like when that cover came up, like his face gets illuminated, in the dark and it just so many great little details in this episode. I mean, there is nothing left to do with things where they're at right now, but to go ahead and retrieve that gun and take care of things himself. I think I mentioned before, I had seen this in the past. I forgot that he actually gets the gun and like sits back down and pops the window. He goes at him. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, and every other time the gremlin like pulls away, or at one point looks like he's pulled a ripcord and flies back. And this time the gremlin's like, "The hell are you doing, man?" He's sucked out onto the side of the plane and just starts firedly wild it. Like into this thing and must have hits it like six times. It's an incredible end of this episode.
Oh, it's like the window goes, you think that's it, but then they hold on it and he's like firing at the camera, screaming, you know, bloody murder. Apparently, you know, at this point, I don't even know if he's not even trying to save the flight. It, really what he's trying to do is, you know, banish this torment from his mind. You know, like that's the true sort of like core of this. Like, it's this thing that he can't escape. And there's apparently no other recourse but to just kind of, release the pressure essentially, which also, I guess it wasn't a jet plane. There was like a turboprop plane, but people were not getting sucked out that window.
Yeah, no, it is also very in almost every Shatner role, like, well, I guess I'm gonna have to take care of this myself, and he just like half throws himself out of a plane to do so.
Yes, it's a very good point. This is we might have been talking about this earlier, but not on mic. One of the reasons he's so good in this is it's a combination of like the Shatner we know, the take charge Shatner, you know, but also the vulnerable Shatner, like that you don't see as much of, and him really being, you know, as paranoid as he is in this, combined with like this, because even did you pick up a little bit, like even when he's like talking with his wife and he's clearly, you know, not, he's a shaking shell of a man, there is still that kind of like, Bill Shatner-y, like, he was getting real handsy with his wife. Lots of grabbing and shaking and like chin, you know, that thing where like you get the chin, you're like, oh, sweethearts, you know, like,
yeah, totally.
It's just such a mix of everything. But I don't think I've ever seen him as vulnerable as he is in this role. And I think, I don't know, it's really up there for me with just how much of the episode hinges on him alone and how he's able to deliver.
Well, and in so many of his roles, I mean, you know, Star Trek and, you know, Hooker as well, he seems to know everything no matter what. And here that's a burden, which it rarely is otherwise. Because, like, the point in the other things is he's going to get away from the space, like, the space ooze cloud or whatever. And in Hooker, he's going to solve the crime. Here, it's literally driving him to insanity. Like, I think one of the best little things is they're trying to give him a sleeping pill so he sleeps. He takes the cup of water but doesn't swallow the pill, and you see him spit out the pill, and you're just like,
yes.
Oh, he's gone. Because now there's no way to say that he's not crazy, because he's now also avoiding the medicine like he's in a psych ward.
He's clearly practiced at that from his 6 months in the nut house, not taking his meds. I love they came back around to the sleeping pill, and that you're right. That moment where you see that he pretended to take it, but he didn't. That was like, there was no coming back from that. And that's really where things, kind of went off the rails.
Yeah.
Like the end of the episode, he leans out the window. He's firing like crazy. And you think, like, this is it, like the plane's going to go down. But then they kind of cut right to it on the tarmac. And you're kind of, surprisingly, things are okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's on a gurney. and there's like a kind of a post-mortem scene happening here. But it's revealed at the end, though, in that kind of classic Twilight Zone fashion, that the panel that the gremlin was futzing with on the wing was torn up, and you're left wondering, you know, was that really happening?
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, I think you mentioned it earlier, like, I think in your mind, is that something, do you leave with that kind of interpretation of it, or is it open to debate?
Yeah, I've been questioning myself the whole time. Like, is it better if they pan all the way out or not? Like, I think it's interesting that they justify his insanity, because the whole thing is maybe more of a metaphor on our own fear of flying in general. And it's an acknowledgement, yeah, that sometimes things do happen and we're right to be afraid to fly. But yeah, it's something.
Do you think that because I kind of saw it as two ways, and actually you mentioning fear of flying is interesting too, because that just made me think of, like, when this came out in the mid-60s, flying is still really new.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of take for granted now that, like, you know, we grew up, you know, getting on a plane is just something, you know, a lot of people are used to, you know,
right.
To a fault too. I think people fly too much in general, but back then it's this thing that you might be watching this and you've never stepped foot on a plane. So yeah. It really could be speaking to some anxieties there that are pretty, like, ingrained isn't the right word, but vivid maybe is the better word.
And actually, to that point, I think it makes it more intense that it's the 1960s, because these women are all in dresses, these men are in suits. It makes it feel like a much more serious affair. Like, if I'm half asleep with earbuds in wearing an old t-shirt, it doesn't have the same impact if I'm like, dude, there's something on the wing.
Yeah, if Shatner's sitting there in his sweats, you know, with jellies on and like headphones flipping through an iPad, it'd probably be like, nah, you know, this episode of 90 Day Fiancé is more entertaining than what's out there.
So, I mean, I guess you've already at least given your rating on Shatner. We'll get to the end and we'll talk about which episode is better. But, like, this is some, like, primo class Shatner. Like, we don't even get him screaming that much. Like, at the end, it was almost like Wrath of Khan, where he's, like, really like, someone pulled one over on him and he is furious. There's something on the way. Like, and he's in a cold sweat. It's amazing.
It's primo Shatner. It was a primo ending. I thought it, to me, it was a little sort of left open in that, like, you know, the wing of the plane, maybe that was from him shooting at it and not the gremlin himself, which I thought was kind of an interesting mix too, where it's like, is that a product of his insanity, or is it proving that his insanity really, you know, wasn't insane. You know, the craziness is out there in the world, and it takes the, only some men can see it.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, totally, Ben. All right. Well, let me close this one out. The flight of Mr. Robert Wilson has ended now. A flight not only from point A to point B, but also from the fear of recurring mental breakdown. Mr. Wilson no longer has that fear, though for the moment he is, as it has been said, alone in his assurance. Happily, his conviction will not remain so isolated much longer. For happily, tangible manifestation is very often left as evidence of trespass, even from so intangible a quarter as the Twilight Zone. That's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words. And now that you said it, I kind of hear it again. And it's like, well, all right, maybe Bob is a, I don't know. They could be alluding to that a little more cheekily than I'd heard the first time.
Yeah. Ready to hop to the next episode?
Let's do it. Let's hop.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
All right, our second episode this week is The Living Doll, the 126th episode of The Twilight Zone. Good on them. The score, so this is, again, one that we almost don't need to cover because you've heard of it before. I'll give the opening narration here in a second. It tells you everything you need to know. Talkie Tina, a doll that does everything. A lifelike creation of plastic and springs and a painted smile. To Eric Strader, she is the most unwelcome addition to his household. But without her, he'd never enter the Twilight Zone. This is scored by the great Bernard Herrmann, written by Charles Beaumont, and directed by Charles Serafin, who is like just a TV guy, probably best known for Vanishing Point. But the star
is it Richard Serafin?
Richard Serafin, yeah.
Yeah.
And although the star of this one is not William Shatner, it is Telly Savalas, who plays the most terrifying dad of all time.
Oh, we trade one big fat dynamo for another. Oh, man. Telly Savalas, what a presence on screen.
Yeah, he is like a hunk of angry beef in this. he is like a head above, you know, his wife in this. He is just this at one point he's sitting on the couch cracking walnuts and smiling, and it is the most like unsettling thing you can imagine.
It was amazing. That maybe it's my favorite scene in the episode. I absolutely love that, because like who cracking walnuts, like no one does that. It's talk about the Twilight Zone. Like, yeah. That's from Mars right there. It was so good.
Well, it's funny because like, I think of like, I've had a long day. I want to unwind, have maybe a beer or whiskey and like Triscuits with cheese, you know, something like that. How is his after dinner snack terrifying? Like, how does that happen?
Well, you know, it is a, I just kind of realized this now. You know, again, the Twilight Zone, always one step ahead. It is a visual allusion to what happens later in the episode, if you think about it.
Absolutely, actually.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, again, you know this episode. Annabelle, his wife, buys their daughter Christy a wind-up doll named the Talkie Tina. And the beginning of it is terrifying. He's like, just run in, don't show your dad what we got you. And he's like, so what did you buy? He's sitting at the table staring at the door. Again, it's like coming home after midnight, your parents waiting for you. Like, it's chilling to the bone.
His big bald dome is like right there waiting for them to walk in. And from the get-go, you're sort of like, now, unlike 20,000 Feet, I had never seen this episode before. So this was brand new to me, and I loved it. But it was also, this is another Simpsons classic. This is from Treehouse of Horror 3.
Yeah.
The year before 20,000 Feet aired, which was Treehouse of Horror 4. But yeah, this is the episode where the Simpsons Homer has to do battle with the talking Krusty. And another, you know, loving homage to the Twilight Zone. So I knew that for sure, that episode inside and out. And some of the suspense for me here was like seeing how they were, like what parts of that cartoon that I know so well will be directly reflected in this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, are we going to get a shot at some point of the doll with a butcher knife, like diving after Telly Savalas? Like, oh, all right, we'll see. Like,
well, and it's funny to watch how The Simpsons does these, because obviously these two are classics. I think The Shining one is up there too. But like, you make jokes because they're so terrifying. This one veers a lot because the base material is so terrifying. You can't make Homer this creepy, you know? And like, you're right, because the question too is always, is Eric going insane? These two episodes pair very nicely because it's about a man who thinks he knows something when no one else believes him, really. And like, we don't know if Takitina is really doing anything, because, and even at the end, the way he dies is he kind of trips on the stairs, which will do it, but it doesn't prove that the doll is necessarily behind anything. And then we get the last line, which is truly spectacular.
It's fantastic. It's another beautiful Twilight Zone twist, that final thing at the end. But yes, like, these are very much kind of mirror episodes of one another, with Telly Savalas and William Shatner playing characters where you don't quite know like where they're, what vibration they're on. Are they full on nut house, or are they a little more sane than you think? And the way that they play with that, on levels of reality are just something else. I guess a question for you. I mean, I know pretty directly why you reached out to me for the first episode, you know, William Shatner being in it and all. But I realized this now, why you're reaching out to me for this Living Doll episode.
Yeah.
You can disabuse me of this notion, but I believe, you know, my expertise here is that it features an insane Eric.
Perfect.
Is that? Yeah. Okay.
I won't even challenge that. No, absolutely not. You know, sometimes these things work out too perfectly to even argue with.
So I took the scenic route to that joke. I couldn't help myself.
We get the scene where, I think the first thing she says is Eric pulls the string and it goes, my name is Takitina and I don't like you and I want to kill you. Like, it just gets worse and worse. And therefore he starts taking out his anger on the doll instead of just the family, which is something. That's really something unsettling.
It's underpinning this too is I think this is what makes it like, you know, Savalas, amazing performance, just like Shatner. But this episode doesn't hinge so much on him alone, because there's a lot of stuff underneath this that really kind of helps, animate things. Obviously the doll, but like the dynamic between him and his wife is so, there's so many more layers to it in this one, because it's like, they're this seemingly second marriage for both.
Mm-hmm.
They have, there's this daughter from her previous marriage, assumedly, or maybe it wasn't a marriage, but, he has a stepdaughter, And I think they allude to like the fact that they can't have kids themselves.
Yeah.
So you have to assume like, you know, maybe something's wrong with him, but they don't specify like, is he sterile? Is there like, you know, there's some underpinning of just like deep resentment that's behind, you know, everything here that kind of helps inform this, like, you know, cause he could easily just be a grump, like, yeah. Oh, he's a grump. But there's much more there. And it really is like, it makes it effective.
Well, and there's that scene. I think he has like a line like, so you bought her a doll to represent the children that we can't have. And you're just like, whoa, buddy.
Right, like, oh, yee.
Sometimes kids have dolls, man. It's totally fine. Right.
Wife has some line where it's like, well, if you choose to look at it that way, I thought that was a good line.
There's only one joke at the beginning. It's not a joke. It's a line that ages very poorly where she's like, I charged it, honey. He goes, yes, but how much was it? He goes, don't worry. I told you I put it on the account. And you're like, that means he still has to pay for it. It's like that old joke of like, oh, no, we put it on the credit card. It's already paid for. You're like, no.
So he's just a workaday slob, you know, a ham and egger trying to manage his finances. Like that's all this is. Like, honey, you know, we're on a budget here.
Oh, no, exactly.
I don't love your daughter. We're on a budget.
That's right. But like, we got to talk about his craziness, because like with Shatner, it's a slow burn. He gets more and more. Eric turns on a dime, and like first he throws out the doll, and then it comes back and starts threatening him, and then he goes nuts.
Oh my God. He's unhinged from the get-go. You know, the paranoia, it gets dialed up to 100 right away. And did you catch, I think it's that first dinner scene where they kind of make a point of the fact that he's like drinking coffee at night. I thought that was a nice detail.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like he's just like wound up, you know? But yeah, like the doll, which at this point now we've seen a couple of really like creepy, effective shots of like the doll's eyes opening and the weird voice, like, saying these creepy things just to him, you know, and it's like true to form. It's always when it's just him and the doll. Same with like Shatner looking out the window, like no one's like looking out the window with him. So it's that same formula of like, you know, is it just me or is this really happening?
Right.
But he goes nuts. Like he thinks it's his wife.
Right. That they're playing some mean trick. And it's funny, we didn't talk about this in the last one, but like in the first one, I'd argue that, I mean, now, of course, we assume we're rooting for Shatner because it's William freaking Shatner. But back then, he wasn't as big of a household name. He was probably more of a character actor that if you watched enough stuff he was on, you'd be like, oh, it's that guy. And so, like, you're probably less sure whether you should be rooting for him or not. You're not rooting for Telly Savalas in this episode. Like,
oh, no.
He takes the doll from his daughter at one point, and she goes, Daddy, don't. And he goes, I'm not your daddy. And you're just like, whoa, what fresh hell is this? Because, like, again, like, I mean, I know there's some people I know who aren't really, like, don't have kids. They don't really know how to handle kids. But this dude actively does not want to deal with her, and it's crazy.
He is a tremendous grump, and it is the way he can pull off that line and like make you believe it. I mean, this is to Savalas's credit in the performance. Like you're just like, that's, oh my God, my jaw was agape at that line. Like yeah. He's just told this kid, you know, straight up, like, I don't love you. Like you're not like, get out of here. Like, But in a way that was like kind of dismissive, that I don't know, like, you know, that old, like, it had a flavor of like the old, you know, get out of here, you bother me,
right,
to it. That kind of, I don't know, it helped it a little bit. So it wasn't too over the top.
I mean, I think the scene that nails that the most is the one you mentioned earlier, which is the dinner scene, because like it starts out with Christy pretending to feed the doll. Right. And, you know, be a good girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Chirper. And he goes, you eat your scepter, Christy. And
right.
The doll winks at him. And then it immediately turns into this conversation where, like, he is drinking his coffee or whatever he's drinking from that cup, you know, his anger cup. And it just starts building. Like, he's like, oh, wait, the doll can do what? Where did you buy this thing? And he goes, the store. What store? And you're like, why does this matter? Why are you going nuts for this reason? And again, it's just building on that tension of what should be a scene where you're just, dude, the kid is pretending to feed her doll, to making it a thing, which is very unsettling.
And he went right into, like, the previous scene, he had just kind of what seemingly calmed things down with his wife, you know, after the first kind of blow up at the doll, confronting him, telling him that, you know, she didn't like him. And then it's sort of like, okay, like, they're, you know, she's calmed him down, you know, but then, like, I don't know, was it the, like, that night, or do you think that they were kind of fast forwarding a little bit with that cut? Maybe it could have been, like, further in the future, actually, now that I think about it. I think she was wearing a different outfit, but it felt like not a lot of time had passed before he just, like, comes right around again to, like, this doll, you know, F this doll. And yeah, like, the, you know, where it goes from there, as soon as that doll winked at him, it was basement time.
Yeah. And he really, like, I forget what it was. What pushed him over the edge? I think maybe it's "and I hate you." But yeah, he puts it in the trash can, and then he receives a phone call like it's the opening of Scream or something.
Oh my God. Yeah. He takes it.
Opening nuts.
Which, by the way, putting it in the sack and throwing it into the trash can, I was like, aha! Like, that was an exact kind of thing that happened in the Simpsons episode, which was like, all right, I have my little checklist here.
So these socks are making me woozy, I think, was the line.
Very good. Yeah, you're right. The thing, there was a, I think it was a, just before we get into that, there was a commercial break.
Right.
Where the doll, you know, turns the doll around, and the doll gives him a, like, you know, the stakes are upped now, because the doll goes, my name is Talking Tina and I'm going to kill you. And then boom, cut to commercial. Like, bravo, Rod. Bravo.
Yeah. And then he comes out of his, like, how are you doing that? How'd you make a call? No, it would have, if you picked up the extension, we would have heard it. It must be the girl who's doing it. And you're just like, whoa, that is a leap. It's also,
he confronts the wife. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's also him saying that you wife, you couldn't figure it out. It's your 10-year-old daughter who's smart enough to figure it out, which is something.
Clearly, she's the one that's been tormenting me all this time. So he goes up, sees that the doll, you know, from where he left it in the trash can, is now, it's in bed with his stepdaughter.
Yeah.
And so he wrenches it out of her tiny hands. She's crying, bring the doll back, daddy. The girl calls him daddy.
Yeah.
Oh, and then Savalas, he whirls around, you know, bald head shining, brow furrowing, and he gives her "I'm not your daddy." Oh, what a line.
And then he tries to crush it in a vise, just melts it with a blowtorch, and takes a circular saw to it, does nothing.
This doll torture sequence was amazing. He's, you know, it's down into the basement the second time. Again, like the Twilight Zone, you know, the way that they made this show is so good. They put that camera right behind the vise. So, like, you see him in the background open the door, and the vice is in the foreground. He's, like, staring right at it, you know. And there's your allusion to the cracking walnuts. Like, yeah. He was, you know, cracking those walnuts. He's going to crack that doll open. And he puts the doll's head in the vice and, like, starts to rah, 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 and you see, like, the little doll head kind of smooshing a little bit. And it's just like, oh, how they made what is kind of a goofy thing seem so skin crawling is just like, it was amazing. But yeah, that doll is made out of, it's clearly a Skynet prototype of some sort, because he takes a rotary saw to it and it doesn't do anything.
Well, and this is his character turn too, because he's been angry dude the whole time. And here you can see the like the malice and the joy from destroying it drain from his face into a kind of like terror. Like he really, like he is terrified. And you know, he takes twine, wraps it around the doll's neck, puts it back in the sack, and then covers the trash can with bricks.
That'll learn it.
Right? Like, what do you expect to happen? And then he goes upstairs and is shocked to see his wife packing to leave him.
Right. Which, which, by the way, what did this woman see in this man?
Right.
Like, what is the basis of this relationship? Like,
well, especially since he clearly feels like impotent or whatever, because they can't have kids. And she has a daughter. None of that is new. It's not like the daughter just showed up one day at the age of 10. Right.
Yeah. No, this is, they decided on this, you know, this is, weddings don't just happen. Like, also speaking of, you know, impotence and all that, I thought another great little detail was separate beds. Did you catch that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, classic 1950s or 60s, I guess. This is actually their Halloween episode. This came out November 1st, 1963. So,
you know what? Actually, you know, I joke about that, but separate beds.
I know.
You'll probably get a good sleep that way. No feet in your back or like,
yeah,
rolling over onto the and then like, yeah. You know what? Now that I think about it. Might have to
go the full Bert and Ernie.
Have a chat with my wife. Full, do you want to be Bert or Ernie? Oh, goodness.
Yeah. But yeah, man, at this point, he's like, I'm sorry, don't leave me here, and returns the doll to Christy. And at this point, I'm not sure what he's feeling, if he realizes that he's overreacted because he's crazy or that this has to be in his head or what. But I don't know, man. Once the table saw goes into effect, I'm pretty sure you're not crazy and it's an evil doll.
Yeah, like that's something clearly where it could be like, look, honey, I know you think I'm nuts, but watch me try to saw this doll's head off. Nothing is happening. Like the sparks are flying out and this thing is just sitting there like it's nothing else.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's clearly like the fear of losing that as well. Like he's already lost his mind, but like, you know, if he's going to lose what little is left of some structure in his life, he's like, that kind of shocks him back into being like, oh no, this is, you know, this is all in my head. He kind of denies it, pulls the doll out again to bring it back to his daughter. The doll gives him a line. Oh, did you catch this line?
And I'm going to kill you, or is that?
She's like, I'm never going to forgive you.
Yes. How great is that?
Oh man. Fantastic. And, you know, so returns it seemingly back to normal, but it does not take long for the tables to turn. The doll's been warning him this whole time. Like, you know, you're going to get it. Like, you're going to get it. And, you know, meanwhile, I've been watching thinking like, okay, in the cartoon, like Krusty's nuts. He's running around. He's like dunking Homer's head in the, you know, the dog bowl. He's knifing him. He's like what are they going to do in this episode to have the doll get over on Telly Savalas, on Crazy Eric?
Right.
And I thought the way it was handled was perfect.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's one of those things that they occasionally do very well, which is just kind of, you know, the horror of everyday life, which is, did you hear something in the hallway? I'm sure I heard something in the hallway.
Yeah.
And he just kind of stands up, checks on the daughter, does the right thing, checks on the daughter first, looks around. She's fine. The doll's not in bed, but she doesn't seem to have moved at all. And he goes,
do you think he was checking on the daughter or checking for the doll?
I don't know, man. All I know is, God, that's such a good question. And it depends on if you think his wife convinced him of anything or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like a lot of good Twilight Zone moments, it's not answered. It's kind of left for you to kind of ponder.
Yeah. But one way or another, I guess he's going to go check the front hall or, you know, downstairs or whatever. The doll is hidden in the corner of the third step and he just falls down the stairs and presumably dies.
I think that in the ending narration, they say that, like,
yeah,
you know, that did him in. The doll was, yeah, it was on a step. He hears this thing, you know, and they do kind of put in this weird little, like, white noise type sound effect. Yeah. It's kind of like, what is he hearing? But he gives a, you know, he gives a classic like banana peel slip on this doll, and he goes crashing down the steps and clonks his noggin, seemingly to his end.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, for having such a thick skull, Eric sure did bite it pretty easily.
Oh man!
When he fell down those shag carpet stairs,
that is some high quality fall acting. And then, like, And then the mom picks up the doll, and Tina opens her eyes and says, "My name is Taki Tina, and you'd better be nice to me."
Oh my goodness!
What a thing! Oh,
what a finish!
Yeah, finished strong on this one.
Did you like too how when he lands at his end, you know, when he finally flops down at the foot of the stairs, the doll lands like right next to him, like right in his face,
right?
Like, bravo, Twilight Zone.
And his head is up at first, right? We see him kind of almost half conscious, looking at the doll, like, "You freaking did it!" And then he just goes limp. Like, there's that moment where he looks at the thing and he's just like, "Damn," right? That's something.
Damn.
Yeah. Well, I'll give the closing narration, which, like you alluded to, kind of gives the thing away. Of course, we all know dolls can't really talk, and they certainly can't commit murder. But to a child caught in the middle of turmoil and conflict, a doll can become many things. A friend, defender, guardian. Especially a doll like Taki Tina, who did talk and did commit murder in the misty regions of the Twilight Zone. And again,
there we go.
And I guess at the end we learn that the thing that was in the house was Rod Serling just standing behind the door jam waiting to get this closing narration. It'll get you.
He phased in, you know, he slid in, or what was that, sliders?
Yeah, sliders, he slid,
It went from dimensions and that thing. Yeah.
I'm impressed that you didn't say he teleported in.
You know, he has many methods of interdimensional travel. You know, he is not pinned down by one method. He's the best. This is definitely going to get me kind of going. I didn't realize like so much of it was just on Netflix. I'm going to be plowing through some more, I think.
Well, and I mean, like, I guess my last thought on this before it gives up, like, how terrifying is that little voice, the doll's voice?
Very effective. It's very effective.
It's June Foray, the woman who did Rocky the Flying Squirrel for Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh, get out.
Among like 30,000 other things. She was Cindy Lou Who and like Smurfs on Smurfs and like, you know, and everything. But, you know, she was everything. So which of these two episodes do you think is better? Which one would you recommend?
Oh, man. I knew this was coming the whole time. And I thought I had a good answer. It's a cop out in the sense that, like, I want to say, you know, they are so much of like the same coin, you know, because they're so similar, like with the characters, the main actors, the kind of physical similarities, like, and the quality too. I think they're both high quality. But if the message is like, you know, to someone that has never seen either, and if they have to watch one, I mean, I'm on here representing, you know, William Shatner and the TJ Hooker podcast. So I clearly have to go with 20,000 Feet.
Yeah. And see, it's funny. I'm with you. I think both of these are incredible just because if you've seen the parodies, you don't get quite how dark and crazy they are.
Yeah.
You know, like I almost want to suggest The Living Doll. So both of them get suggested, but like Telly Savalas's version of the dad is so different than the Simpsons version. This feels like a much more different episode than the parody version, because, you know, the Nightmare at 20,000 Feet really does feel like the Simpsons episode, other than you can't match, you know, Billy Shatner, who really just, he chews that scenery. He does what could be done with, again, very few lines, but it's all in his face, which is remarkable.
He's very, very good at chewing.
He sure is. He sure is. So yeah, I think I'm going to recommend The Living Doll just because it freaked me the hell out. But both are worth your time. But yeah, Ben, thanks for being on. Anything you want to plug before we go?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, a pleasure to be here. I appreciate, you know, reaching out and introducing me to your world as well. We'll certainly be checking out more of the Myopia podcast. And I think this Twilight Zone is a great little addition here for, you know, the times we're in now, and a fun side project. But, you know, we both recommended Billy Shatz and the William Shatner episode. So if you want more of William Shatner, head on over to tjhookerpodcast.com. We have all the shows over there. And while you're at it, just follow us on social media. At TJ Hooker Podcast on Twitter, facebook.com/TJ Hooker Podcast. If you can't tell, that was me doing the standard thing that we do at the end of all our shows. But reach out. You know, if you've never listened to it, I think you'll have a fun time. And maybe, you know, keep an eye in the shadows. Keep an eye, you know, one eye open. Because we're going to do some exploring out there, you know, in the nether reaches. We're going to find something in the zone that's worth unearthing, I think.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. Ben, thank you so much for coming out. And hopefully we can have an excuse to have you around again.
Right on.
The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Doodletter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, panelled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is 6 Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.